Hey everyone, before we get into my chat with the fabulous Ms. Neon, gonna tell you a little bit about patreon.com/Craig and Friends. Yes, patreon.com/Craig and Friends. Not only is it the home of Hot Dog Club, it's the place to find an ocean of exclusive and fabulous content. So go over there now, check out the reward tiers and see which one works best for you. We got the $1 tier, which is kind of just like, hey, I like your show, I want to support it, and you get some like voicemails, you get a couple other fun things. You get up to the $5 tier where you get the bonus episodes, lots of bonus episodes, and of course, you unlock the entire archive once you sign up. Then the $7 tier gets you the bonus episodes plus the listener questions episodes, and of course, the $10 tier gets you all of the above plus the Movie Club episodes. Now, upcoming movie clubs include Tootsie with Tammy Brown, What's Love Got to Do With It with the Vixen, and for Halloween, a very special Peaches Christ appearance for the Witches of Eastwick Movie Club. The 9-to-5 Movie Club I just taped with Jake Shears and Karen from Finance will be coming out later this week, and over the next few weeks I'll be taping listener questions episodes with James St. James and Bitch Puddin'. There's other options available now as well, they're fairly new, including the Hot Dog Club weekly Zoom meetup, which is always a highlight of my week, and other reward tiers that go all the way up to She's an Executive, where you can join Brian Necht and Lindsay Rose, the People's Candidate, at the top tier available. Also want to mention something I usually forget to mention, please hit subscribe on your podcast player or follow if you're a Spotify listener, and rate and review. Of course, the 5-star rating is the most sophisticated, and you are a sophisticated crowd. Anyway, now that that's out of the way, let's dive headfirst into my chat with the fabulous Ms. Neon.
A Russian ballerina stomping on a bureaucrat, a perky suburban housewife who just got into scat. It's whimsically volatile.
Nice to see you again.
Yeah, nice to see you too. How have you been?
Good. I mean,
considering everything, yeah, sure.
It's been a really illuminating time.
That's true. It's true, actually. Absolutely. Yeah. And you know what? Before we get too far into it, why don't I do your intro?
Sure.
Dear listeners, on this episode, we get to know the queen hyena alpha bitch who's the cop fucker with her pussy stick. She was raised in Natick, Massachusetts, and is currently making Los Angeles a more glamorous place to be. Please join me in giving a warm and wet, whimsically volatile welcome to none other than the fabulous Ms. Neon. Welcome.
That was, wow, how do I follow that? Can I hire you to just, like, say that every time I have to do a show or meet anyone, basically?
Absolutely. I'm happy to arrange,
especially
something.
On dates, I could really use that.
No problem. I'd like to be the advanced man on that. That'd be fun. Yeah, that'd be good. And also, you know, like, you gauge the reaction, because if they're not gonna go along with that, or if they're like, what the hell's going on, you don't have to deal with the date, you don't even have to worry,
right?
About it. Yeah,
yeah, take it or leave it.
What's dating been like in the pandemic for you? Because for me, it's meant no sex since February 13th.
I mean, it's, oh God, I don't, it's, oof, gosh, how do I even navigate this question? The challenges I face are definitely exacerbated.
Sure. I didn't know if it was going to be extra califragilisticexpialidocious or however
that too. Yeah, I don't know. There's just been a lot of talk, and you kind of really get to see who's a total sleazebag and who's interested in getting to know you.
Sure.
Ooh, I don't know. It's kind of scary.
It's a hard thing to negotiate, and it's not like there's a rule book in terms of like, well, just do this, this, and this, and you'll be totally fine.
You've been isolated by yourself, as I have been, I'm pretty sure. So yeah, it's tough. I mean, it's definitely part of me that really loves being alone and the autonomy and the just sort of like unbridled me time, redo the house and work on a bunch of projects.
Going a deep dive on with Kiss or Dawkins or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I don't know. I've like been reading more books and just listening to a lot of podcasts. I was actually just listening to your latest podcast with Jackie B.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. Thanks so much. Yeah.
Speaking of Kiss.
Yes, exactly. Kiss has been on the brain lately. Definitely did a re-immersion, as I discussed on that episode. And we were chatting the other day about Rat, the big favorite of yours.
Oh, hell yeah. Totally.
Yeah, do you have a favorite album of theirs or favorite song, or is it just the whole thing?
Honestly, their first two records are just great. I was never really one for hair metal particularly.
Yeah.
But I remember when I was working at Pat Fields back in the day, I was, you know, it was me and my best friend who both worked there that were kind of the only two people that were really like rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And I found two Rat CD. It was like CDs, you know, it was like one of those six CD changers. And I found two Rat CDs and I was like, all right, I guess I'll just give this a shot. And I just put them on and they were on shuffle just like all day.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, Rat is great. And it was like, it was the kind of music that no one complained about.
Oh, right. Because
when I would play like the Plasmatics or like anything else, someone would just be like, what is this noise? Rat was like this happy middle ground of like rock and roll that was easily digestible.
Yeah.
And Pat never complained about Rat. So I was like, okay, we can keep Rat in rotation. And I just always loved them. And they just seemed like they were kind of like an actually good band that wrote good songs. And it's not to disqualify all the other bands in that genre, but to me, they just seemed different.
A cut above, perhaps, yeah.
And of course, Beavis and Butthead always made Rat. Like, that was how it was on my radar.
Yeah, sure. And the videos are fun, too. So if anyone listening hasn't seen the videos for Round and Round, they're quite fun. And they got a little bit of drag in them, too.
Isn't that whole movement just really drag? I mean...
That's exactly like I was talking about with Jackie. Yeah, it really is.
Right.
It really is. And then, like, in Decline of Western Civilization Part 2 as well. That's a good document of that era.
Oh, yeah.
Well. It's oh, so God. Good. Yeah.
I've only seen it in bits and pieces because it was only on, it's probably on the internet now.
Matter of fact, last time I checked, it was on Amazon Prime, but for years it was really, really hard to find.
No, it was. I remember because I was like trying to find it and it was really impossible.
You know why? Penelope Spheris didn't think that there was much of a market for it. She owned the rights to it. And I think there might've been some music clearance issues, but primarily it was mainly her just not realizing that people cared. And her daughter helped her to get the idea that they should do a re-release of all three. So the first one about the punk scene, for those who haven't seen it, is really good.
What's the third one?
Third one's about the gutter punk scene, I think, and I haven't seen it because
really?
It was only shown at like film festivals for a long, long time, and there was bootlegs of it, but now there's a Blu-ray set of all three, and I think all three are on Amazon Prime as well, so it's a good reminder I should check out the third one.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, but you mentioned the Plasmatics before, and you're a big fan of the Plasmatics,
oh,
right?
Yeah. They're like my favorite band, probably.
Do you remember when you first got into them?
I do. I was 17 and I was in New York. Mm-hmm. I got accepted to the Parsons School of Design, had like a summer program. I got accepted to it. I was staying on 8th Street initially, right across the street from Pat Field's old store. And that's how I discovered the 8th Street store and the whole Pat Field's world. And really the whole downtown New York culture.
Yeah.
That summer was really like so memorable for me. And I remember I had this really cool art teacher and I was there for like an advanced life drawing thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. And my art teacher was super fucking awesome. And he was really into music, all types of music. And I was just getting really, really, really into punk rock and like the first wave and new wave and post-punk and like all that stuff.
Yeah.
And he introduced me to the Plasmatics. I mean, the internet was like around, but, you know, that's when I would still dig through dusty old bins of CDs and records and stuff. And I remember buying my first Plasmatics CD at St. Mark's Sounds on St. Mark's Place. It was way more intense than I had even anticipated because I was thinking it was going to sound like The Cramps or something like that.
Yeah.
And the album that I got was Coup d'etat, however you say that.
I think that's it, Coup d'etat.
That's their real like kind of metal crossover record. And I was like, fuck, this is heavy as fuck. And I was kind of like really intimidated by her voice and how masculine her whole vibe was. And I was just, I was kind of scared at first. And that's when I know I really like become obsessed with things when I'm like kind of freaked out.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't know. Wendy's just always been one of those really just, I don't know, iconic female just archetypes for me.
Mm-hmm. And for those listening who are not familiar, it's Wendy O. Williams. So you might have heard the name Wendy O. Williams or the Plasmatics, but that was her band. She was the leader of that band. Also, she worked with Kiss a little bit. We have to throw them in. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, they all played. Yeah, they all played on her first solo record.
Yeah. And of course, she was in a bunch of movies too, right? So Reform School Girls. Were there others?
I know Reform School Girls. There has to be something I'm not thinking of right now, but...
There must be, right? I can't
I've
think of
I've always been really curious about... I mean, she was definitely older when she started, which I always thought was really cool, too.
Yeah.
And she was straight edge, which a lot of people don't know as well.
Right, because a lot of people would like assume because of the very like sort of I guess outrageous stage show, etc. You know, smashing up TVs with sledgehammers and then Cars as well. Didn't she take chainsaws to Cars?
She blew up Cars on stage. I mean, there's nothing more badass than that.
Exactly.
But I know that she used to be like a stripper or a go-go dancer or something before she started that band, because that's the rumor is that's how Rod Swenson, her manager and also lover for a long time, which I didn't know about for a while, found like a back page ad of her like on a subway floor or something. Mm-hmm. And just got in touch with her. And that was how the story goes. So I have to imagine there's probably some crazy like porn movies or something of her that exists. I don't know. I don't want to be spreading any kind of rumors, but like she definitely had like a sex worker past before becoming, you know, the rock star that she's known for. So
right. And she did a lot of work to save animals as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So when we talked about you moving to New York at 17, would that be straight from Natick?
Kind of. Well, I actually moved a couple of years after. I was still in high school when I was doing that summer program, but
I see.
That summer was and definitely sold me on, okay, I want to work at Pat Fields. I want to move to New York. And I started recording my first like solo project in my bedroom after that summer. Mm-hmm. And then it kind of got circulated around, ended up in the hands of Larry T, who was doing the Electroclash thing at the time.
Yeah.
And then he invited me out to do a bunch of shows. And then through that, I got kind of integrated and I met Sushi, who was the then buyer at Pat Fields. And he literally offered me a job there on the spot. And it was like this magical opening to New York.
Yeah.
And I was working at a retail job at the time called Alston Beat in Boston.
Oh, I'm familiar with that.
It doesn't
place.
Exist
yeah.
anymore. But it was kind of like the Pat Fields of Boston or like the Trash and Vaudeville of Boston. It was like a punk rock kind of shop. And so, yeah, I just, you know, worked there for like a year-ish and made my transition from there. But yeah, I was living in Natick. I had a lot of friends in Boston and stuff, and I was always hanging out in Boston and usually with like kids that are like a lot older than me.
They got a lot of those old kids in Massachusetts. I'm from Massachusetts, so I know.
That's right. Where are you from again, exactly?
Well, I grew up in Sudbury, and I worked at the Newbury Comics in Natick. I think once we talked about how well, I may have sold you a
That's
record
right.
at one point. Yeah.
That's fucking crazy.
I know.
Newbury fucking Comics, kid.
The old Sherwood Plaza. And that Sherwood Plaza was fantastic. At least it used to be, because there was the like rundown fifth run movie theater. Next to it, there was a great Chinese restaurant. It was kind of like one of those fun old school strip malls. And then it became a lot less fun. And then Newbury Comics moved out. So.
Wow. Yeah. Massachusetts is a wild place. I used to love going to Bickford's on Route 1.
Me too. Bickford's is great when you're in high school and all you want to do is drink coffee and smoke cigarettes. That's the place to go.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. We had this waitress. Her name was Sheila. And she was just, she'd be like, how you doing, honey? Let me get you some more coffee. And she would just let us hang out there for hours and just smoke cigarettes and... Gosh, yeah. So many revelations were had at that place. That's actually where I came up with my name, Neon.
Really? Do tell.
With a friend of mine.
Yeah.
Well, I now am known as Ms. Neon, but prior to that, my full name was Neon Music. Mm-hmm. And when I transitioned, instead of really, I chose the name Neon in a sense because it was androgynous. And I just kind of dropped my last name and added a prefix mm-hmm. instead of... doing the whole name change thing. But I remember jotting that down on a piece of paper, Neon Music, and I was like thinking that would be a song title or something. I didn't know. And then my friend was like, that should be your name.
Yeah.
And I was like, fuck, that's it. My name was birthed at Bickford's on Route 1 in fucking Massachusetts.
See, Bickford's brings a lot of inspiration to the youngins. I don't know if they're still around Bickford's, but hopefully there's another.
I doubt it.
Yeah, I think you're right. When you talk about making your music and everything, when did you start getting involved in making music?
I started when I was in high school, really. I mean, I had been playing instruments since I was about 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm. Which instruments?
My dad is a pianist, mm-hmm. and he had me playing piano when I was like 5 or 6 years old, and I hated it at the time, and I was such a fucking brat about it.
Yeah.
But I'm obviously so grateful that I did that, because it gave me so much... theory yeah. that I've applied to everything I've ever done. And when I was like 11, I was getting into rock and roll and I really wanted to learn guitar. After that, it was kind of just like, I knew I wanted to be a rock star and being in bands was how I started.
Yeah.
Started playing guitar in a band in high school. Our first show was like eighth grade talent show or some shit. We killed all the lights and yeah. just had strobe lights going on. It was super 90s. I then transitioned to being the singer of that band and I started playing synthesizer. And we had a good run with that band. We actually won the WBCN Battle of the High School Bands.
Amazing. Yeah.
I won't say what year it was, but Dickie Barrett was a judge and he was from the band The Mighty Mighty Bosstones, who sure. were very big at the time.
Right. I think he's now the, or at least recently, was the announcer for the Jimmy Kimmel Show as well, for those who need a more contemporary reference.
That's right.
Yeah.
Gosh, it's been so long since I've seen him. I would love to catch up with that guy. He was so, so cool. And especially with me being a queer kid, like being in bands was really my only salvation mm-hmm. when it came to being able to express my gender nonconformity.
Yeah.
You know, I always looked up to people like Bowie and, you know, Marilyn Manson was really big at the time. And he was very much like the gateway drug to finding out about like Alice Cooper and Ozzy and all the great underground goth industrial stuff that sure. I got into subsequently. But the androgyny factor was like, it wasn't acceptable. I didn't even know what a trans person was at that time. Mm-hmm. And being on stage allowed me to express my gender fluidity, however you want to call it, and contextualize it, and people got it. I felt like people got me, and you know, I definitely put up with my fair share of bullying and all this other kind of stuff, but once I was in bands and I was doing all this stuff outside of our town, and then when we won that contest, Dickie Barrett invited us to open a bunch of shows for the Mighty Mighty Bosstones.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And then, you know, we were like 15 years old going on like a little mini tour with the Mighty Mighty Bosstones and H2O and all of these like punk and rock, like ska and punk bands. People kind of started to leave me alone and were a lot nicer to me, I think.
Yeah.
That really helped me just feel like I had purpose in the world mm-hmm. and also just made people sort of like respect me, I guess.
Sure.
So it really made high school a lot easier because I mean, there was definitely a lot of fucked up shit that happened, but I always kind of kept my eye on the prize and that helped. That saved my life, honestly.
Right.
So that's where it all started. And then I veered off into a solo project towards the end of high school and through my experience in New York, I had a whole bunch of bands, the most noteworthy being a band called Youthquake. That mm-hmm. was kind of like a punk rock, queer core-ish kind of band. We played a lot of amazing shows. We did a lot of shows with the Voluptuous Heart of Karen Black, Pansy Division, Reagan Youth. We even opened up for Bow Wow Wow.
Oh, fun.
One time.
Yeah.
And, you know, that carried me through most of New York. And then when I moved to L.A., I had always been thinking about wanting to rap.
Right.
I just kind of started fucking around, recording some demos. And I was like, wow, this feels great. And it just feels like an opportunity to rebrand myself after I transitioned because I hadn't really at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, yeah, to make a long story short, that's kind of like the spectrum of where I started and where I'm at now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll get into some of the specifics of that, or else we'll just end the show. But your new EP, Queen Hyena Volume 2, right, is out. It came out last week. Although yeah. this won't air at the same time I'm saying it. So it came out recently. It's new. It's hot. It's hot on the hot off the presses onto your Spotify and other listening sources. One track in particular I was going to ask you about is Myra Breckinridge. I'm going to play a little clip of that.
My Myra Breckinridge. Leave it to me, the motherfucking mind, mind, wreck-breaking bridge.
And of course, to hear the rest of that, head on over to your favorite listening source and fire up Queen Hyena Volume 2. I wanted to start with that one because, of course, you're referencing the infamous film and book, Myra Breckinridge. Is that a favorite of yours?
Certainly. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite films ever, really, and just the concept. The book I have, you know, I've gotten through probably half of it, and it's amazing.
Yeah.
And I don't want to front like I've actually finished the book, but I feel like it's one of those things that I almost just love. I just kind of want to like draw that out as long as possible so that there's something always new to discover with that storyline.
Sure.
It's a character archetype or an egregore, whatever you want to say that. Yeah, I don't know. Especially when I moved to LA, I'm just like, this is, it's just mirroring so much that I relate to. And Myra Breckinridge is like my fake name that I use on anything, like my Uber and my Postmates and like whenever I'm getting a coffee. Or...
Sure. And for listeners who aren't familiar with the film.
I am Myra Breckinridge, whom no man will ever possess. The new woman whose astonishing history started with a surgeon's scalpel and will end who knows where. Just as Eve was born from Adam's rib, so Myron died to give birth to Myra. Did Myron take his own life, you will ask? Yes and no is my answer. Beyond that, my lips are sealed. Let it suffice for me to say that Myron is with me, and that I am the fulfillment of all his dreams. Who is Myra Breckinridge? What is she? Myra Breckinridge is a dish.
And don't you ever forget it, you motherfuckers, as the children say nowadays.
For a little historical context, I think that was the first film, right? First major film with the trans lead character.
Sorry, I just dropped my mic. One second.
Oh, that's okay. It was a drop the mic moment, not the kind that you'd normally.
Right? Usually it's everyone else dropping the mic. Yeah, I mean, that it's crazy that that movie came out in 1969
right.
or something.
Yeah.
And this is still a, I don't know if you saw the Netflix documentary Disclosure.
Not yet. I've been meaning to.
It's
I've kind of
really stayed, amazing.
I've kind of stayed away from any real life stuff during this time.
Well, it's amazing. It's about the history of trans representation in cinema and mm-hmm. television. And I won't give it away, but it's really, really, really important, I think, especially for cisgendered people to see, because it's really informed how trans people have been perceived societally, politically, socially, and everything.
Sure.
TV and film, really. It's unfortunate, but it's the reality that that informs, you know, how we treat other people and how things become normalized.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So Myra Breckinridge was really a pioneer in the sense that it cast a very famous, gorgeous, cisgendered woman
right.
to play a trans character, which is still being debated. There's merit to not having that always be the case, but it's... When you have an overwhelming amount of cisgendered men playing trans women in film,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't really acknowledge the real female existence of the trans character. It depends what the storyline is about. It depends how far along the person is in their transition. It depends on a lot of factors. I was prepared to hate Jared Leto's performance in Dallas Buyers Club, but mm-hmm. I thought he was actually amazing. There's always exceptions to any rule, but Myra Breckinridge was definitely a pioneer in that sense. And Raquel Welch got a lot of shit for it. And I just respect that creative decision so much. And I partially did that song as a lyric just for fun, but also because in any hopes that people will be like, oh, who, you know, the kids or whatever will be like Googling Myra Breckinridge, or, you know, there could be more awareness around that film.
Sure.
It's not very well known.
It's infamous to some, been completely unknown to others. So I'm glad we're talking about it.
The irony in all that is there's a lot of rumors about Mae West being stealth trans.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
You never heard that?
No, no.
I kind of wrote it off like, first of all, she was really, really, really tiny, even for a cis woman. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that doesn't, that, you know, not, whatever. It would explain a lot. I don't buy it necessarily, but I want to.
Sure. I know exactly what you mean. Those kind of the legends or things where you're like, I can't, but I want to.
But Raquel Welch said something about it in some interview that I stumbled across on YouTube a few months ago.
Yeah.
And she was like, it was shady as fuck because there was a notorious feud between them where Mae West was just, she was notoriously horrible to all the young actresses.
Yeah.
Especially with Raquel Welch.
The limousine that brought her to the studio and to her dressing room also brought her onto the set. So the big, huge doors that, you know, they bring the scenery in. Well, she was kind of a piece of scenery, really. But this huge car would wheel in, and then she would get out of it, and she would come and sit in her chair. And by that time, I also noticed that she wore shoes, you know. Well, I've got the shoes on today, too, but she wore the high shoes and then the platform on top of that and the long dress, so you really couldn't see what her real height was. But when I went over to say hello to her, she sort of extended her hand to me, and I went to kiss the ring. And with that, one false fingernail, painted silver, fell to the floor. And I looked at the hand, and I thought, oh, I'm getting a vibe. I think she's a man.
I imagine she would have handled it more delicately now. I don't think it was necessarily, I wasn't offended by it. I'm sure someone would be. But, like, I've since heard even more, like, stories about that there was another film that I actually hadn't yet seen. It's really hard to find, but it's...
Sextet?
Maybe. It's another film from that era that has a trans character in it that wasn't played by a woman.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Not Sextet. I was thinking about another Mae West film that's sort of infamous, but...
It's impossible to find because...
What's it called?
I can't remember the name. Someone just told me about it, like, very recently, and I was shocked that I hadn't heard of it, but the premise of the film is that it was buried because the story was supposedly based on Mae West, and she had it, like, shelved or something.
Sure, sure. Well, that's rather intriguing. I'm certainly going to look that up, and if I can find it, I will let you know.
But I get it. Like, it was not a safe place to be trans then, and, like, you know, there's something to be said about being stealth when you grew up in a time, I mean, even up until just a few years ago, I mean, even now, like, passing for me is more a means of just safety than anything. So if you were a cross-dresser or something, the best you could hope for is to just be a comic relief bit character on anything.
Sure.
Even now, that's, you know, trans people are still kind of anecdotal for the most part.
And you mentioned the thing about safety. I mean, of course, recently there was that terrible attack on three trans women in LA, and no charges were brought.
This shit happens everywhere. I mean, I was in a situation, it could have gotten to that point, but didn't, thankfully. But it's like, you know, the other thing about passing, it's just like, it's a means of survival, but it's also like, becomes a double-edged sword because so many guys feel that they can just come up to you and say whatever the fuck they want. And then when you kind of can't say anything because it's like, if I open my mouth, I don't think I sound trans, but I don't know, some people, like, it's hurt me in the past when I've said anything back.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's a dude or this or that. And it's like, oh my God. Yeah. It's like a group of guys, it's just, I don't know, it was, I don't know, it's more like when I was like a faggot, I'm pardon my French, but like when I was just, you know, I like the word faggot, so whatever, I used to self-identify as that, when I was just a punk rock faggot, people would just throw bottles at me and call me a freak, and that was it. You know, I'm glad that that's not a thing anymore, but now it's this more loaded thing because attraction is involved, and it's a threat to what someone perceives as their masculinity. And that's such a, like, I don't know. I think that just needs to not enough people are having the conversation about straight men dating trans women and how that's not gay. And there's nothing wrong with being gay, but that isn't in fact what it is.
Sure.
You know, I think there's a lot of bisexuality that can cross over a lot of those lines, but typically speaking, even some people like I know that are friends of mine are like, oh, you're dating that guy. I thought he was straight. And I'm like, you're just calling me a man, basically. Like, you're not,
sure.
You know what I mean? Calling a guy gay for dating a trans woman is ultimately just calling her a man.
Right.
I say this hoping that it might help some people who may be struggling with this in some way, because sorry if I'm getting off topic.
No, no, but, this is what I'm all about. I like this. You know, you've heard the show.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had guys write me privately who are like straight guy friends of mine who have said like, you know, I'm seeing this trans girl and I don't know how to like come out about it, or, you know, if that makes me gay or this or that, the other thing. And I've said on multiple occasions, I said, you know, you don't have to come out as anything.
Mm-hmm.
What you just have to do is back your girl up and like affirm that she is a woman, you know,
yeah.
And if anything, just double down on the fact that you're a straight guy. You know, you don't have to come out about shit, because that infers that there's a queer element to your relationship that may or may not. There's all sorts of queerness and all sorts of spectrums, but most cis normative trans women just want to be seen and navigate through the world as a cis woman, or, you know what I mean? As like a straight girl, you know? And when the queerness factor is always brought up, it's really, it's kind of triggering. It's always just a reminder of like, oh, well, you're not really a woman. You know what I mean? You're not really a girl, or, you know, and I'm not conflating trans being the same thing as biological women at all. But there's that whole thing. So I just think it's really important for men who are attracted to trans women, which is really very common.
Sure.
To just know that, like, you know, unless you're really into like a whole spectrum of sexual preferences, you're just still a straight guy. And all you have to do is just be proud to be with your woman and take her out on dates and hold her hand in public and tell your mom about her.
Yeah.
And like, it's really on them to dispel the fucking bullshit that is perpetuated about trans women, because that it's the kind of thing that goes on behind closed doors when it's just a group of guys cracking jokes about, oh, it's a dude, or oh, this, or oh, that. And it seems like a fucking cute fucking antidote at the time, but that's how these trans girls get murdered. It's not cute. So sorry to have a soapbox moment with that, but
no, this show is all about soapbox moments.
You know,
it is.
that really made me very, very upset to see what happened to those girls, because it's just inhumane on every level, but it also, anyone trans that was watching that knows that that's just like always a threat. That's always the threat. And I never lived my life in fear. And I had a lot of people writing me concerned when I was reposting all that stuff. And like, I just got this self-defense kit. I already had some stuff, but they sent me this really, really like top of the line self-defense kit from the Trans Defense Fund. Mm-hmm. And I shared that, and a lot of people were like, are you okay? This, that, the other thing. It's like, I'm fine, but you'd never fucking know. And it's not about, I'm not like projecting that I'm afraid of anything. In fact, I'm pretty fucking fearless, and I'll continue to navigate the world without anyone saying anything to stop me. But it's really important to know that, that kind of stuff is just always a threat. It's always in the back of your mind.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
back to the Disclosure documentary and why that's so important. I'm not going to give it all away, but it really goes into the history of how trans women are always portrayed as like, oh, it's a man in a dress and it's funny and it's humor, and that invalidates the experience of trans women. And when I see shit like, you know, like Tyler Perry and like certain things that I just think are like, I don't think we need to go back in time and like, I think for the time that we live in now, I think that that's not really appropriate anymore. Sure. I think there was a time where that there was Mrs. Doubtfire, all these kinds of things like, all right, you know, I don't need to cancel Mrs. Doubtfire. That ship sailed, but let's try not to like make more content like that, because it psychologically reinforces the stereotype that trans women are out there to fool men.
Sure.
And that's how a lot of men take it, as if our existence is a lie.
Right.
And we're doing it to fuck with men. And it's like, bitch, I'm living my truth. And if you're attracted to that, like, deal with it. I don't know, because most of the violence that happens towards trans women is because men are attracted to them, and then their boy fucking makes fun of them for the fact that, or something. And it usually has something to do with that.
Right.
You know, it's always like a guy like hollers at me. A lot of times he knows already, but when I don't answer, then it'll become a fucking thing of like, oh, you're a faggot or this or that, the other thing. And it's like, whatever.
Right.
So
a very loaded moment where it seems like there's no way to win.
You know?
Yeah.
I think there's a way to just be like more mindful of the caricatures that exist around trans women. And I'm a caricature in my own way, but as a person, as an artist, you know what I mean?
Sure.
And that's part of the reason why I wanted to rap about being, you know, all the things that I talk about. A lot of it has to do with my experience as a trans woman, because I just feel that it's really important to put that out there with my narrative.
Yeah.
And it's mine and mine alone. And there's lots of different realities to the story, but at the end of the day, we're people, you know.
To one of those songs, the first time I saw you live, which was opening for Christine, I was really taken with this track.
Legs for days in the shade, sipping lemonade.
That was a lovely introduction to your work. I love that song, and I love the very punk nature of it, very political nature of it, and then in a context that I maybe didn't expect given the show I was going to see.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
And I love the deliberate choice of words and everything.
Give me an example. What resonates with you about that song?
I think because the first thing that I heard, because, you know, it was loud, it was at Precinct, and it's what you know about chicks with dicks, right?
Yeah.
Actually, I think I filmed some of it too, so maybe I'll put a clip up, because I just got my new Osmo Pocket like the week before, so I was excited to film some stuff. And then I was like, oh, wow, when it sort of dawned on me what you were singing about and everything, and, you know, you look great on stage and all that, so it was like this whole thing. That's why I got in touch with you, like, shortly after that, yeah. I don't know if I have a question on that, but because you were talking about how your work is related to your experience and your worldview and all of that stuff, and I think you achieved that rather well.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And I appreciate that you picked up on the fact that it's punk rock, because I feel like punk rock to me is not so much about a genre. It's, you know, the whole fucking, it's an archetype, you know?
And an attitude and everything.
I used to always say, like, you know, my gender is punk rock, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that was more my introduction to gender performativity, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word, but like, glam rock and punk rock and all that kind of stuff was like, whoa, this is a whole other thing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was actually the first rap song that I wrote. And I was doing a lot of like, kind of like synth pop, Italo disco kind of stuff.
Oh, sure. Like I Love Success.
Yeah, yeah. And I love that kind of music. It's like, I mean, I always kind of say like, you know, high energy and Italo disco is kind of like my punk rock. And Pete Burns from Dead or Alive famously said about Divine, Divine was one of the very first like high energy artists. And high energy is sort of like a subgenre of Italo disco.
Yeah.
And Dead or Alive really popularized that. And Pete Burns said, when I heard Divine's music, that's what I thought punk rock should have sounded like. And I so agree. It's just like, it's just great. I love that kind of music, but there was a limitation for me in the ability, like expressing like lyrics and being like sort of contemporary and doing something that wasn't nostalgic in any way.
Sure.
So I was content doing that kind of music, but I was getting the bug to want to do something different and to do something that hadn't been done before and to try something that I hadn't tried yet, which was rapping. The first time I actually rapped was for a friend of mine who is a producer. We were doing a performance together, and his producer name is Papaya, and he used to be like a really big top 40 producer back in the day. And I was having like a conversation with him about like, yeah, I've kind of been thinking about like wanting to rap. I don't know why. I just feel like I'd be really good at it. And it's just like, I don't know. I just like, I love Lil' Kim. She's a punk rock icon in my mind.
Sure.
I grew up listening to a lot of hip hop. And he was like, well, why don't you rap a verse on this song of mine and see how you feel? And I did it. And it was like a short verse. And I was like, fuck, this is great. And immediately I just started fucking around with Pussy Stick, and the beat and everything was just totally experimenting, just having no outcome in mind necessarily.
Sure.
And I just started writing the lyrics. I wrote the first verse and then the chorus. And after I wrote the chorus and I listened to it back, I got like I was saying before about Wendy O. Williams, I got scared. I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Am I really saying this? I've always wanted to hear this, but I never thought it was going to be me. And like, it's like, wow, there's no going back. I can't go back to doing cutesy synth pop music once I do that. Like, there's no transition. And I was just like, this feels real. This feels right. This feels like because lyrics were always sort of an afterthought for me. They would kind of just be like anecdotal lyrics that were kind of vague, that would fit into the music and sound phonetically.
Sure.
That's like more how I would write in like a more rock and roll context. But this is just more free form. And I was just able to say so much more and all the experiences that I had. I mean, I'm not old, but I'm not young. And I've been through a lot of shit, and it's really led me to this point. And I always kind of felt like there was a reason why, I don't know, just why everything's happened the way that it has.
Sure.
And then I just started writing and writing and writing and writing and writing. And I just spent like most of 2019 recording an album's worth of material and mixing and mastering. And then throughout the course of this year, I've just been putting out a couple EPs, and there's still some more material that's going to be coming out for a full length. But I don't know, I'm rambling, but
no, that's okay. Don't worry. It's a podcast. Like, that's what they're made for.
Yeah. I don't know. I just felt like it was something that needed to be said and needed to be heard. And especially in like the rap world, there's not like enough trans representation. They're starting to be, which is great. Mm-hmm. And it's ultimately just music to me.
Sure.
I don't know. It's,
well, it functions on many levels, right? It's not just a political statement, right? And it's not just something about representation. It's all the things. And those are some of the most interesting things, right? It's like a many layered cake. You know, the phrase chicks with dicks is kind of a provocative phrase, because me quoting your lyric is one thing, but someone just saying that, you know what I mean, could be very insulting. You reclaiming the language, or, you know, just claiming the language, how would you phrase it? Because I wouldn't know.
I think that's a really good assessment. And I definitely think that's, you know, it's definitely the taboo factor. Like, straight guys love that song. It's really funny. And interestingly enough, most of my audience is male, like according to my Spotify algorithms, which I was sort of surprised by. It's like 2/3 male. It doesn't say if they're straight or gay, but, you know, I'm here for everyone. I'm here for everyone that's into it. And I think it's tricky. It's tricky to
see. Now you're quoting Run DMC, but I get that. That's okay.
Oh my God. That's good. It's good, but it's definitely provocative, and it's definitely, it's reclaiming, I guess. And I don't know. I love the word shemale. I just think it's great. Like, but it's another one of those things, and there's plenty of examples in rap music that I'm sure I don't need to get into, where, you know, what the person is saying, you may or may not be able to say back as a listener. And I think that really forces the audience to consider really where that person is coming from. And it kind of humanizes the experience in a way.
And it also, I think, confronts the listener with whatever either preconceived notion or maybe prejudice or, you know, you name it. There's a list of, or a whole host of things that can be summoned up by the use of language by the appropriate person who is taking something back that may have been used against them. And, you know, and that's true in many styles of music, or in writing and literature, whatever, film.
Totally.
Whereas a lot of the Italo disco stuff, and I love it too. What I love is how bad some of the lyrics are.
Oh yeah.
That's like a whole art form.
No, it really is. The other part of that for me is just expressing the notion that being a chick with a dick is cool. You know, that it doesn't conflict with me being a chick. And
you're still rhyming. See, this is the pro that you are.
It's such a great rhyme too. I mean, it's just one thing.
I meant right now too. I just meant right now, because you said conflict. And
I've noticed since I start rapping, I tend to rhyme more in real life. It's actually kind of funny.
The more you do, the more you can do.
I think historically, a lot more trans women got gender confirmation surgery because the world could never accept them otherwise. And while there are still plenty of trans women that do seek that affirmation through surgery, and that's completely valid, there are plenty of girls out there that don't. Mm-hmm. And I never did. I never felt like I was trapped in the wrong body personally. I knew that it would be an evolution for me, and it was a journey, and that I was meant to experience both sides of this. And I always knew that from a very young age. Mm-hmm. And I really loved being a boy with androgynous leanings. And I always felt like I had a elder female sort of wile about me when I was a younger boy, that I would eventually just sort of be a woman. I didn't see myself being a man.
Sure.
And now that boyish part of me is very much like, I love that part of me, but I flipped the scale, and, you know, I I, you know, society, socially identify as female and all these things, but it's a lot, obviously it's a lot more complicated than that. And I don't, I'm not, you know, I don't want to overcomplicate it for other people.
Sure. Just, well, I mean, you know, you're just talking about how you feel and yeah. that's how you feel. Right. So, and yeah. also, you know, anatomy doesn't dictate gender.
But I think it's really interesting the fact that so many like straight guys resonate with that song.
Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping that it can have an effect to help normalize the way that straight men treat trans women. You know, not all by any means. There's a lot of really great guys out there. It's a little edgy. It's a little provocative. But at the end of the day, it's about saying, you know, this is valid. You know, it's not, I don't need to have a vagina to be the incarnation of femininity that I feel comfortable with. And I'm hopeful that not, certainly not just for men, but that for girls too, that, you know, there could be just more understanding and conversation and just more like zeitgeist kind of like knowledge of like being a chick with a dick is fucking badass, you know, in my opinion. And it's not for everyone. That's just me. I don't know. I'm just speaking only for myself. But right. But I'm not like the trans ambassador. I'm not saying you're saying that, but just.
Oh, no. I didn't think. And I am not saying that. No.
I'm sure there's trans girls out there that may be offended by that. I really don't know. Anything's possible. Everything's something to be offended by these days. So I don't know. I'm just like living my truth, and it's not always pretty, but it's certainly sexy.
Indeed, it is.
And sexuality for me is very much, sorry to keep rambling, but it's like,
no, please.
I think that there's also this, you know, the female sexuality is very much vilified, and it always has been. And, you know, like WAP by Cardi B is so great. And like, there's always the backlash of people saying it's exploitative and all these things, but it's like, you know, the male equivalent of that is like bodybuilding and strength and virility and all these things that society doesn't demonize.
Right.
And that's the male prowess.
And also the male description of sex acts, et cetera, or talking about like that, you know, we're talking about hair metal before, you know, how many of those songs are just, you know, but that's like not even thought about.
But the sexuality of women, at least for me, like, I mean, so much changed with me hormonally, you know, when I transitioned, and that's probably like a whole other conversation, but I always felt like this even prior to my transition, but even more now that like my sexual energy is more of a spiritual experience, and expressing that has less to do with actually having sex or the act of sex. It's like this energy. It's an energy just like positive thought is an energy, or chanting or anything. It's an energy, the sexual energy. That's why, I mean, sex magic is a thing for a reason. The sex energy of the female is it's generally more transcendent and spiritual, and I think it's received a lot of times as being, I don't know, it's just demonized. Like, females are demonized for the exact same behavior that men are celebrated for. So I think, you know, me expressing my sexuality, there's a lot of, I think, depth to it beyond just being sexy and provocative. There's like, sexiness really represents a really transcendent spiritual thing that is much more distinctly female. It's not entirely just female, but it's definitely more of a power thing. And
would you say also like a self-confidence thing?
Well, yeah, sure. Yeah. But it's like more art. I don't know. For me, it's like artistic. I just feel like it's like a, I don't know. It's relating to the god. I mean, Venus is, I worship Venus. She's my goddess. And there is a lot of healing that sexuality brings to the world. And doesn't mean that every woman has to be overtly sexual, but it doesn't mean that being overtly sexual necessarily even has to do with sex as much as it does an energy of it's an alchemical kind of energy. It's magical energy.
And you referred to when you began your transition. When did you?
yeah, I started transitioning in like 2016.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking I would just start the process and see how it felt. I wasn't in a rush to feminize necessarily. I just wanted to be more androgynous, and I wanted to kind of just preventatively stop my body from aging as like a male.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've always been very thankfully like a very naturally androgynous, and I've always looked like young for my age. So I was like, if I'm going to do this, I might as well do this now.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's harder to transition for a lot of people the older you get and the more that your male features really set in.
Okay.
And I still looked like pretty kind of like I always sort of looked like a twink, you know. I always was kind of a twink. That was like my thing, you know what yeah. I mean? I was just like a punk rock twink until I became a lady.
Sure.
And I started on a testosterone blocker, and then I had to take estrogen at some point. I didn't really want to right away, but I had to like reintroduce like a hormone into my body. And I was a little bit reluctant at first because I was like, oh, I want to just take this slow and see how I feel. And mm-hmm. I'd only been on the T blocker for like a month or two. My doctor was like, you either have to like introduce a new hormone or go off of it. And I was like, okay, I'll try it. And then it was like a Snow White Disney movie. Like I took it on my birthday. I woke up the next day and it was just like the birds were chirping and braiding my hair, and like I just felt amazing. I wasn't yeah. even considering the like emotional or psychological or anything. I was really just trying to aesthetically like transhumanize myself mm-hmm. into an alien, basically. And I just felt amazing. And I started looking like, I don't know, all my clothes started looking good, like better on me, and like my body dysmorphia was like really coming down. There was a lot of like latent depression and anxiety and all sorts of things that I didn't really think that I had that bad mm-hmm. that were just so much less. I don't know, I just felt so much more comfortable in my own skin.
Sure.
So much happier, and people were so much nicer to me.
Uh-huh.
Which was kind of crazy, and it really says a lot that like there's still so much stigma. Like I don't know, people have so like, you know, the way I used to dress when I was like a twink, people would think I was crazy and shoot me dirty looks. And then all of a sudden, like being a woman, people would be like, oh, you're stunning. So it's like, I'm, you know, it's like lovely to hear that, but it's also like, wow, you know, it's like guys, a lot of the frustration I had growing up was the fact that men didn't have very many options.
Sure.
Of, like, how to express themselves stylistically. And, you know, interestingly enough, I feel like I have way more privilege as a trans woman than I ever did as a man. I hate that word man for me, but I can never assimilate as like a cis normative guy.
Sure.
No matter what. So, but I can more as a girl now. So it's kind of interesting. So yeah, I don't know. It happened a lot quicker than I had anticipated.
Yeah. And then you found it when you did, a lot of things lifted that you didn't even know were weighing upon you.
Yeah. I don't know. I was just really ready for, I don't know. I was ready to really face a lot of things that I hadn't faced before. I wasn't super happy in New York, but I felt kind of like I had a rent control apartment there.
Can't give that up. They kill people, please. Yeah.
You know, and I had been wanting to move to LA for a while. I was coming out of a relationship.
Mm-hmm. How long was the relationship?
It's like 2 years. And it was one of the most significant. It was the most significant relationship for me so far in my life, because it was the first time I ever felt like I was really humanized.
Uh-huh.
It was the first guy that, like, we met. I mean, I was there wasn't a word for that then, but I was like definitely very femme presenting.
Sure.
Like I had like a skinhead girl haircut and I was kind of like a tomboyish girl, but like people would think I was a girl most of the time. And mm-hmm. I honestly liked that.
Yeah.
So I met this guy on this really shady tranny dating website, not thinking I was just like, what am I even doing on here? Whatever, let's see what happens. And this guy wrote me, you want to meet up? And I was like, okay, fine. At that point, I figured I was really hopeless. I had a lot of really scary and horrible things happen to me with men.
Okay.
And I was always just terrified the next guy I was going to meet was going to murder me, because it mm-hmm. almost happened. And it was like, there's always that fear, but it's different. The way that hormones work in the male versus female body are so different. Like I would take a lot more risks as a boy than I would ever do now, because back then I just felt like, well, I'm unlovable, so I don't know. Like, this is the best I can. I'll just take what I can get.
Sure, sure. When you felt like you were unlovable, your risk taking, was that in all aspects of life, or just with men, like, you know, dangerous behavior or self-destructive behavior in general?
Well, the guys I was dealing with, I never really felt like I was gay, and I was never really that attracted to gay guys. Mm-hmm. And I had some relationships that were sort of situational, and they were very fun, and it was like cool and whatever, but it didn't really feel like I was always attracted to straight men, since I was attracted to men.
Mm-hmm.
I now realize it's like I was always hardwired like a girl, you know, and there was always those guys out there that were like DL,
sure,
for lack of a better word. And all you girls out there that fuck with those DL guys, do not do that to yourself, because those are the men that will, those are the dangerous ones. You know what I mean? There's always a danger.
Mm-hmm.
There's more of like the danger of like just female stuff now, which is a whole other thing, but back then I was primarily dealing with guys that were very, very closeted about everything. And the fact that I wasn't identifying as a girl at that point, it was just very confusing.
Sure.
You end up dealing with a lot of less desirable people.
Right.
It took someone that was basically, I met this guy. I didn't think anything of it. I was just like, God, I hope this guy doesn't murder me, whatever. He ended up being my boyfriend for 2 years, and he didn't give a fuck. And he never dated a trans woman. He never dated a queer, whatever. And he was just like, I love you mm-hmm. for who you are, whatever pronoun you want. He told his mom about me before he told all his friends and all his family and everyone, didn't give a fuck, was so open.
Yeah.
Like, just having a guy holding my hand in public was like, how did I ever put my, like, you know, because as much as it was these horrible guys that treated me like shit, I fucking put up with it.
Sure. Sure.
And I had to learn like hard lessons that I'm glad I learned. I learned how to respect myself more.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned through that relationship that I was like worthy of being loved. I really didn't think I was.
Right. And you can just take that as the accepted wisdom. You know what I mean? When you're in that for a long time, when you're in that state.
So he was a great guy. And he was this big, he was a railroad worker when I met him.
Uh-huh.
The most blue collar Boston hardcore dude ever.
Yeah.
Like, terrifying looking guy and a sweet boxer, everything. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, the most archetypal, like, heteronormative guy ever.
Yeah.
And it was amazing to see how, especially in the punk rock scene, there was still like a lot. I think there was like an extra layer of homophobia in the punk rock scene, because all punk rock guys get called faggots all the time anyways.
Sure.
So,
and there's a strange incidence of sort of Republicans and right-wing ideology that's clung onto by some punk rock people and heavy metal folks as well. But a friend of mine and I were talking about Johnny Ramone the other day, and just like, he was kind of a despicable guy. You know?
Yeah, I've heard. I never dug into him too much, but like, yeah.
But anyway, the strange thing is, in a scene that you would think would be sort of welcoming to all manner of people, because they themselves know what it's like to be considered the freak or the outcast, etc., there yet is still within that group that kind of stuff.
It takes a real, yeah. I mean, it takes a real fucking man to not give a fuck and just like be honorable. And I think that's like, that's the best of what men are.
Sure.
And I think that there's lots of qualities about men that are less desirable, and toxic masculinity is a very real thing. But let's not just say that's all men are, you know what I mean? Like, there are really good guys out there. And I think it's like, it takes someone like whatever, Brian, you know, he doesn't talk to me anymore, but I'll always love him.
Yeah.
He really saved my life. And I know that a lot of guys saw him as being like, he changed a lot of people's perspectives more than I did. Mm-hmm. Because I was more perceivably easier to write off because I was so unconventional. But that's really important. Coming back to the whole thing around, like, whatever, you know, guys who date trans women, like, don't fucking ever just try to, like, be behind closed doors with a trans woman. And trans women do not enable that. It's dangerous. And those are the stereotypes that are bad. And it takes a few really strong guys of
chainsaw
character.
Wielders outside to really
Sorry
make
about
sure.
The noise.
No, it's okay. It's all right. It's, you know, these things happen. What are you going to do? You know, it's not like you arranged it.
It's very Wendy O. Williams.
I think it is. That's the thing. Yeah. Your band is warming up. They're waiting for you. And that's what they do.
She's here with us in spirit. I'm going to try to close the window, though. Hold on a second. Hormones does also change your sex drive and the way that you interact sexually. It's very, very different.
Could you outline a little bit how it is different?
Prior to hormones, my sex drive was male. Do you know what I mean? It was mostly visual, and it was more of like this demon that wouldn't shut the fuck up, and it was always there. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Any guy on the planet, especially when you're in your 20s and younger, you do foolish shit because you're fucking horny.
Right, right.
And like, you know, and that was half the thing too. It's like, oh, well, maybe this guy is like, you know what I mean? Like,
this is a risky thing, but you know what? I'm horny. So yeah.
Yeah. And especially when you feel like you're not really dateable, you're
sure.
just kind of like that kind of thing. But like as a girl, it's very, 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 very different. It's more emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you don't like the, it's kind of like what I was saying about sexual energy.
Sure.
It's much more spiritual. So the act of sex is always really depending on the connection that you have. And there's so much about safety.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that really, like, men don't consider when they're going out. I'm talking about, like, straight, you know, boy-girl kind of relationships mm-hmm. right now. Men don't have to, like, worry about their safety going on a date with a girl. You know,
sure.
it's a very different experience for women.
Right.
It's like 80% of the guys that hit you up on any dating app, I mean, let's face it, that's where we're at, especially now.
Yeah.
Are just disgusting and horrible. And that 20%, maybe, that's like, okay, like maybe all this, you know, it takes a lot of like echelons to get to a place where you feel comfortable enough going out with a guy.
Yeah, sure.
Because there's always, this is the thing kind of answering your question now, is like, I would never in 1,000 fucking years just meet up with a guy at like my house or his house, or like,
yeah.
that's just beyond the scope of possibility. Like, no, that
right.
screams DL bullshit to me. If you're not, like, if you're not booking a date for me at like a really nice public place, or even just something romantic in a park or something thoughtful.
Sure, sure.
That's, I'm not trying to speak for all women, but I've always, you know, this is pretty like calm, you know, women react sexually to being around men that make them feel safe. And there's an emotional connection that, like, for me to get horny, I have to like vibe with someone emotionally and feel like there's just a lot more at stake.
Sure.
You know? And especially, I imagine, for biological women, there's like the pregnancy. I mean, there's so much to consider.
Right.
Like, there's so much more impact that the female body goes through in sex typically. And all these types of things. So, yeah. And then, you know, the just general sex drive is like, I'm my sexuality is like just in my being.
Right. It's like an integrated part of you.
Yeah. It's not like I don't feel like I need to
scratch an itch, if you will.
Exactly. Or even like porn. I don't know. It's just like weird. Like I'm just like, okay, I mean, that's cool, whatever, but it doesn't, it's not like this sort of like, an itch you need to scratch constantly. It's more like this sacred thing that, and it's always different. Like the way I orgasm now is very, very different. It's always different. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's not like a just sort of click, click, boom kind of thing like it was before. And I'm so grateful for that. I'm so grateful for that experience. And it really, I used to struggle with my sexuality a lot because I was just so wanting to date someone, but feeling like I couldn't. Uh-huh. And then just like straight guys would always seem to like want to hook up with me, but it was always like this really shady kind of thing. And there was plenty of guys that I had fine, great times with or whatever, but it was always at my place.
Oh, okay.
Or at his place, or like not in public.
Yeah.
And you know, it wasn't validating.
Right.
It took me getting out of that to realize how harmful that was. And I'm not criticizing girls that do that, but I highly urge all trans women to not engage DL men because it's not behavior that our society should be reinforcing. And men should do better. And there's plenty of guys out there that do very well, and you should use them as an example. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think that's a perfectly helpful and reasonable thing to say.
How do you identify on the spectrum of things?
I identify as a queer male, and I wasn't really aware of the being bi or queer or pan. And I don't mind the exchange of any of those, you know, like whatever, until sometime in the last 2 years. And I was with a woman that we were a couple for like almost 14 years. So at a certain
point,
which is crazy to me because also it wasn't terrific long time towards it. Should have been over a long time before it was over, but you don't know the difference anymore, that kind of thing. And also I'm very loyal sometimes to a fault.
That's the Massachusetts.
That's right, kid.
We're fucking loyal as fuck.
That's right. That's right.
People from Massachusetts are fucking assholes, but they will have your back forever.
So, but you know, it's funny because you said the thing about things overall sort of making sense. You know, when I did sort of embrace the all aspects of my sexuality, which, you know, there was plenty of clues through the years, you know what I mean? But, you know, you don't know that stuff. Also, and I've detailed this in other episodes, but, you know, I had weight problems as a kid. So when you're heavy, you're not sexual, essentially. That's not how I feel about the world. But when you're a kid and you're, you know, not dating anyone, you're just not dating anyone. So it's not even an issue of whether you're trying to figure out what you're into. And then also the thing of realizing that, that way I talk to some guys sometimes, that's flirting. That's different than when I talk to other guys this way. Do you know what I mean? Uh-huh. There's those subtle things. And I remember when I started to notice that, or maybe acknowledge it, it's hard to say, you know what I mean? As things dawn on you.
So nuanced, sexuality.
Yeah, it really is.
I hope I'm not putting you on the spot.
No, not at all. I like to be put on the spot. It's good. You know, that's what the show's about. It's about like talking about very candid things.
Totally. I was just curious because I'm just yapping away about my bullshit. And
they hear a lot of my bullshit.
We had ever talked about that. Actually,
no, I don't. I don't think
you're very ambiguous, and that's a good quality. I always, you know, ambiguities.
Yeah. No. Listen. Thank you. I appreciate the interest.
I think that's what's interesting about you because you're very queer friendly. Like, if not predominantly, it seems with your content, but it's not like a typical LGBT kind of thing either. Like, you have this ambiguity about you that's exemplary. It's very, it's just very inclusive and interesting. And
thank you.
It doesn't, I don't like really anything that's too much of one thing or too clicky or too much of one group or another group, or, you know, even anything that's just too punk rock or too anything. It's like, I don't know. I'm emotionally engaged by things that I think are more nuanced, generally speaking.
Yeah, same
and,
here.
Most of, you know, I've listened to a ton of your shows at this point, and they're mostly with pretty notable people in the LGBT world and really interesting, amazing, fascinating people at that. But you're sort of in, seemingly ambiguous about where you fall on that spectrum, but in a cool way that's just like, that's awesome.
Thank you.
I think that's really wonderful what you're doing, and it's very authentic.
Thank you. Listen, I really appreciate that. I do. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah. And I think a lot of men struggle with that too, because it's like no one has it. I don't know. I mean, like, I definitely relate to being like a straight girl more than I ever did being a gay boy, but like, I get crushes on girls all the time. I jokingly say I'm like a problematic 90s bisexual that just makes out with other straight girls when I'm drunk at parties. And
sure,
you know what I mean? Yeah. But like, bi lives matter too.
There is a funny thing about that, because you think, or I thought anyway, that when I was confused about my sexuality in my early 20s, because I suddenly was like looking the way that I wanted to look, you know, and then actually getting interest from various people, and then, you know, trying to figure out what I was in, you know, all of that stuff. And yeah, sometimes then if you're then just dating one type of person, you can then have an identity that you think precludes you from being engaged with any other type of situation as well.
Totally.
And you just think, and then especially too, I was, you know, hanging out mostly when I moved to LA with all gay or queer people, but it was sort of like, oh, Craig's the straight guy that is like somehow into all this culture or whatever. So then that becomes a sort of codified identity that you're, oh, but you're straight. Like, that's not, you know, that's not for you or whatever. Like, these weird limitations that you can put on yourself based on your understanding of your place in society, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, I think, and just to like rephrase this, like, I think it's cool that you don't wear your sexuality on your sleeve in a sense, for you. I think it's cool. It's like your brand. It's like, you know, everyone has their thing.
Sure.
And I think that like typically like bisexuality has always been written off. It's like, you know, you could date girls your entire life and then you fuck one guy and you're a fag. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
for
right.
For most people's understanding of things. Sorry for my language. I'm from Boston. We say fag about everything. I'm never going to stop saying it. So. Love ya. But you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, like, yeah. Well, and like, also you're saying it in a way where like there's a sort of persecutive or persecution aspect to it, or like the perceived threat of how you will be perceived if you did try something that you weren't sort of known for, or as part of, you know, the sexual identity that you think you are, or all that stuff. So in a way, that word choice is fairly apt, because you're talking, you know, about someone being sort of heckled for it. And that's the thing.
Yeah, it's like I saw this, I feel like it was a meme or something, but it was like, and this is so true, I feel like a girl that hooks up with another girl is still seen as straight.
Sure.
But a straight guy who hooks up with a guy is just like instantly gay.
Right.
So it's like the idea of bisexuality in a lot of people's heads like doesn't really exist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a double standard. That
right.
If you're a straight guy that, you know, seemingly straight guy that's like bisexual or whatever, if you're just a guy that's bisexual, you're really just gay. And if you're a girl that's bisexual, you're really just straight.
Right. No, that's the common misconception. And it's a really destructive one too.
It's kind of like that really permeates so many like things.
Right.
I don't venture to say I'm bi because I like being problematic. Fake bi. I just think it's like funnier.
Sure. Cooler. It's a good line. Yeah.
but I'm actually saving my virginity for Angelina Jolie.
Look, that's fair enough. You know what I mean? I don't think anyone can fault you for that.
Yeah. But I feel like I can't, maybe you could really like illuminate this a lot more, but I feel like there's more legitimacy around bisexuality nowadays.
Yes.
Do you feel?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I do. Of course, you know, that's one of those things where maybe it's hard for me to say because I'm more either aware of it or a part of posting about being bi. Do you know what I mean? So maybe my perspective is a little colored by that. But I really do think that it is much more, if not accepted, I don't know if that's the word, visible and understood.
Yeah.
Visible and understood, I think, is the key to that, particularly, you know, with sexuality in general. You know, with younger folks, they seem to have a more nuanced understanding of things, which is, you know, great. So that, I think, continually infuses the culture, despite the fact that there's a lot of the culture in America that seems to not want to know anything about that, but that it's hard to parse out what is and what isn't. But overall, I think, yes.
Yeah. I mean, on the flip side of that, I mean, it's just so nuanced.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of things in our culture are really lacking nuance, but like specifically, I mean, you know, even just to go even further, it's like there's guys out there that may like experiment. And I usually think that word is really not the like a good word, but there can, you know, you can still be a straight guy and like fuck a guy and not even be bi. I was going to ask you something actually, like,
oh, this, yeah.
And I'm going to sound like such a boomer for asking this, but like the term pansexual.
Yeah.
How do you differentiate that from bi?
I think because, well, here's what I think it means, that it means that you don't rule anything out based on a hard and fast definition of what the other person is. That's how I come to understand it. But I also consider that to be queer, and that might be different than someone else's definition of queer. So a lot of times, you know, when asked, I say the three things: bi, pan, or queer. Because I tend to say queer first because I like it has a nice ring to it.
I was just gonna say, I'm sorry. Did I somehow?
Oh no.
Use the word bi in lieu of queer, because you did say that.
Oh no, that's okay. No, you said I think you said bi, but it doesn't matter because it's still a valid question, right? So yeah. What's the difference between that and bi or queer in that? To me, they're all interchangeable, except that I understand that some people have issues with the definition bi because it's essentially binary.
Oh, okay.
I like queer best because A, it has the you know, the historical all the stuff attached to it through the years, and it's
ambiguous.
Yeah, it's ambiguous. To me, there's not a distinction between the two of the pansexual is totally different. Pan and queer, I find, are to me the same, and others might have a different thing about that.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, I remember growing up in Boston, and queer was like the equivalent of the word faggot. And
right,
now,
right.
That's why I kind of, I'm just like, hey, we can take anything back if we choose to. I don't think we should be afraid of these words if we're using them, because clearly queer became a pretty political identity. I mean, it's like it's a socially accepted sort of sexuality. And I think that there's something really cool about that. Taking something that's like used to offend you and being like, nope, sorry, it doesn't offend. It's not offensive anymore.
Right. It's not offensive. Like, we love it. Thank you.
I don't know. It's really like, it's like I can play it out in my head being like a little kid and be like, fucking, what are you fucking queer over there? You fucking, fucking queer. That's so fucking queer, dude. Fucking,
yeah. Are those fucking queers?
Yeah. What are those fucking shoes you're wearing, kid? You're the fucking queer. You look like a fucking queer.
Those are classic expressions, especially Massachusetts accent with that. It's like a queer. It's, very specific.
Yeah, it's like queer almost.
Yeah, if someone from England, but they would sound much more dignified and highbrow saying it.
I love the like Massachusetts fucking thing now that I don't hear it anymore. It's like,
oh,
so
sure.
Dramatic.
There's a fun
like when
novelty.
I was around it.
Yeah,
I was like, oh my god, I'm never talking like that.
Me too.
You know,
yeah.
My parents weren't from there though too, so it was I just didn't. Hear it in my house.
Same. My parents are from Canada, so it didn't pop up in the house. Where are your folks from?
My mom's family is from Montreal, Quebec.
Oh, wow. Cool. My folks are both from Nova Scotia.
And then my dad's Dominican.
That's a cool international combination.
Yeah, it's really interesting. My genealogy is insane. My dad's side is predominantly African. Cameroon and Spain, and looks like there's quite a bit of like Sephardic Jew in that lineage, which is really interesting. And then there's just a whole hodgepodge of like a little bit of everything ever.
Yeah.
But it's like mostly Afro-European kind of mix. And my mom's side is like her genealogy is 96% French.
Okay.
I feel really lucky. I really love being mixed race. I So I don't know.
Yeah.
That's more offensive to say, but like.
Well, yeah, I think it's good to be proud of and feel good about whatever you are, right? Like whoever, like I find it fun that I'm Irish, Scottish, and a little bit French in heritage. I had a lovely time in France when I was there. I was only there for a few days, but it was a perfectly lovely time. And I wasn't made fun of for not knowing the language. So that was good.
Wow. That's huge. You seem pretty lucky.
Well, you know, I'm just so charming. That's what are you going to
say? Well, that you are, certainly.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, you are as well. And I've had quite a lovely time chatting with you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And
thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's lovely having you on the show. And maybe we'll chat again sometime, not on the show.
I would love to. We got to have a movie night. Find some outdoor place. And I don't know.
Yeah, let's do that. That'd be great. Because we have a lot of similar movie interests. Actually, and for the show, let's talk just a couple favorite movies because we didn't really talk about movies.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Probably my favorite film of all time is Jubilee by Derek Jarman.
Yeah, yeah.
Film. I'm one of those cult movie bitches.
Same here.
Adamant, it was one of his first roles. And Jordan, who was, oh God, she's such an icon. She was one of the quintessential punk rock influencers, for lack of a better word.
Sure. Anyone familiar with Sex Pistols, you'll see her in loads of photos when they're hanging out at the shop and all
that. She was Vivian Westwood's muse and shop girl. And so it was her. I wish she did more stuff. She kind of dropped off after that. But yeah, it was starring her, Adamant, Toya Wilcox.
Little Nell.
Little Nell.
Who's like the cult movie goddess because Jubilee, Rocky Horror, and Litzomania. It's insane.
What was that last one?
Oh, Litzomania. I'll send it to you. Ken Russell made it the year after he made Tommy. And it stars Roger Daltrey as Franz Liszt. And the premise is that like Liszt is the first rock star. And it's bananas. Paul Nicholas, who plays Cousin Kevin in the Tommy film, plays Wagner. Ringo Starr is in it as the Pope. It's insane.
Wow. You know what I just watched for the first time? I didn't get through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the Monkees movie.
Oh, yeah. Head. Yeah.
It's fucking insane. The Monkees are amazing. They're so underrated. I used to love that. Like, I started watching that they have all the episodes on YouTube. And
oh, cool. I love that show.
That show is so trippy.
It really was.
It's really weird.
And Mike Nesmith is such a fucking genius. He's the reason Repo Man got made. He's the executive producer. And without him, it would never have happened. And he got a nice deal for Alex Cox to make his first film with no interference, basically, from the studio. Interestingly, Jimmy Buffett is in Repo Man.
I love Repo Man. I haven't seen it for so long, though. I definitely need to. I love John Carpenter.
Oh, God. I love John Carpenter.
I love his music. I feel like this whole pandemic is like some fucking twisted John Carpenter movie.
It is. I sometimes refer to the COVID as the thing.
Right? Because his thing is just more eerie than being like overtly like heads exploding and all this kind of shit. So.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But I love those kinds of dystopian sci-fi, trippy horror movies. One of the best and most favorite films I've seen of the recent years is Mandy.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
I forget the director's name. The soundtrack is amazing. The guy actually killed himself soon after that movie.
Oh, wow.
It's really tragic, but it's crazy. Nicolas Cage is in it, and it's just like, takes place in the 80s.
Okay. Yeah. No, now someone was telling me, they were like, it's so up your alley. You got to see it. So this is a good reminder.
It's like this cerebral, it's cinematically, I've never seen anything like it. I can't compare it to anything, but it's crazy. It's crazy.
Sounds good to me. Well, I guess that wraps up the episode. Is there anything else that you'd like to add before we go?
Oh, I mean, I could just list movies till the day I die. But,
we'll do another movie list thing sometime.
Maybe, yeah, we should.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
They're remaking The Craft right now.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I loved that movie as a kid, and my friend just sent me the trailer. I've noticed when I lower my expectations, I'm usually like the Abfab movie, for instance. Like, I love Abfab.
Yeah.
And I was so prepared for it to suck, and it was so awesome. And I think that's my takeaway.
That's a good lesson. That's a good lesson because I entered into it with a totally different expectation and was sorely disappointed. So that's a very good way to get into the things. Yeah.
Yeah.
thank you again. And it was lovely chatting with you. And I look forward to talking to you again. For lots more stuff and plenty more things, head on over to patreon.com/Craig and Friends. Check out which reward tier works best for you. Sign on up and slide on in to the Thunderbuns of Hot Dog Club.